This program is designed to provide general information with regards to the subject matters covered. This information is given with the understanding that neither the hosts, guests, sponsors, or station are engaged in rendering any specific and personal medical, financial, legal, counseling, professional service, or any advice. You should seek the services of competent professionals before applying or trying any suggested ideas.
Welcome to Woodbury Reports with your host, Lon Woodbury, talking with leading professionals about how parents and others can help their struggling teens, preteens, and young adults. Now here's your host, Lon Woodbury.
Welcome back to the Woodbury Report. I'm Lon Woodbury, located in North Idaho. Here is where we talk to knowledgeable people about all things involved with struggling young people and the programs and people that try to help them. Today, we're going to try to answer the question, how do you know when you're done parenting? And the guest is Eric Lauber, a PhD. Now, Eric is the president of Life Framing International and a digital journalism faculty at Indiana University of Pennsylvania. He's also in charge of leadership training and research at the Mid-Atlantic Research and Training Institute and has developed and still teaches the undergraduate leadership academy. He is widely published and, it's a pretty impressive resume of what you've published. But Eric, good to have you here.
Oh, thank you.
Well, this is a question that I've heard. I'm a grandparent, and my reaction, and I think a lot of people have the reaction, is once a parent, always a parent, because kids sometimes come to me for advice, and sometimes they listen to it, and occasionally I have to bail out even my middle-aged children. But at some point, you're not a parent in that you're working with a dependent. So, Eric, could you tell us a little bit about yourself? Are you a parent? And how about your personal background before we get into the professional background?
Sure. Yeah, I'm currently a parent with a co-parent with my wife. We have a 20-year-old, a 19-year-old, and a 17-year-old. And I think that's probably what prompted me writing that particular article. Personally, I was raised with three siblings in a small farm town in Ohio. Went off to college, got a bunch of degrees, and now I'm a faculty. So have some experience with parenting, but I haven't gotten past the 20-year-old stage. So you certainly have more experience than I do.
Well, it gets more subtle, I think, as it goes on, as you have less control. Well, you mentioned how you came to writing about parenting, but sort of a subset under that question is, what do parents need to know about this whole topic of parenting and when you need to back off?
I think that's a really good question. I don't have a complete answer to that. I think it's stepping back and looking at the situation at the 10,000-foot level, if you will. And in the article that I wrote, I kind of begin from having the goal in mind, what it is that you want to happen down the road with your children. If you have a clear idea of that, maybe you can steer a little bit more consciously, a little bit more coachingly, if you will, to get them there. I think everyone agrees the parenting role changes as the kids grow up. And so when I titled the article, How Do You Know When You're Done Parenting? The first answer I always get is, well, you're never done parenting. And I always wholeheartedly agree with that. So let's break the question down and say, well, how does it change? What is it you're trying to accomplish when they're, say, 25 versus when they're 5?
In other words, you have in mind a goal to where you want to help get them.
Yeah. What does it look like to have a happy, healthy kid, 25, 35, 45?
Yeah, well, I think most parents have that in mind, that they sort of lose it when they get into they lose their perspective when they get into the teenage years. It's like when you're up to your waist in alligators, you forget that the original purpose was just to drain the swamp.
Exactly.
Yeah, but the teenage years, it's a lot of fun, and I've taught teenagers in the classroom, and I work with teenagers now as an educational consultant, particularly the kids that are having real problems making poor decisions, and maybe they have some mental health issues, maybe they have an attitude issue on that. So you use the term in the material you sent me of well-being. And I think there's a specific meaning of the term. You mentioned the five subcategories. But could you just sort of in general, what do you mean by well-being?
Well, well-being is kind of a category, a concept that was developed over years and years by the Gallup organization as they conducted happiness research and life satisfaction research, millions of data points. What makes folks feel satisfied? What helps them feel like they've gotten the life that they wanted? They've asked people who are very old, looking back, what were the most important things in your life? And they coalesce just around the concept of well-being, if you had to give it a term. And then they break it down into these five categories to say, you know, people use different words, but we can do social science analysis on those words and find out that what people mean are these five things. And the five things are career well-being, social well-being, financial well-being, physical well-being, and community well-being. When people have all five of those things going in their corner, they generally rate their lives as very, very good.
Okay, well, let's talk abroad and then get more detailed in each one of those. But what might be some synonyms for the term well-being? What comes to my mind is satisfaction of a job well done, that you're happy, you feel good about yourself, things like that. Could you give some of your perspective on that in various other language that you might use just as a parent or a person to describe the sense of well-being?
I think you did a great job. Those first four that you listed are directly on target for me. And I think that what's important to remember is the word happiness is a very emotionally laden term for us. It has, in many cases, a very specific definition, which wouldn't apply to the goal of parenting. I remember my mother saying to me constantly, you know, the goal here isn't for you to constantly be happy. That's not going to happen, and I'm not going to make that happen.
My mother used to say,
she said, no, my goal as a parent is to make you independent. That's what she always said to us. You live on your own, and you can make decisions, and you take control of your own life. That's what she thought the goal of parenting was.
Well, I think it's a wise woman. Wise woman. And let me, in my experience, I work helping parents that have kids with behavioral problems, attitude problems, and things, and maybe need some sort of intervention. And very often, what the parents are saying, I want the kid to be happy, and that's a false goal because happiness is seems to be so nebulous. So exactly what your mother was talking about. No, goal not to make happy, because happy doesn't mean anything, and it just doesn't seem to fit. So there's something better, and that's this well-being you're talking about.
Yes, but it's a close cousin, because when they're trying to investigate whether you have good well-being, they're going to ask you, how do you feel about your life right now? Actually, there are two different measures. There's one which is a retrospective. They'll ask you, how do you feel about yesterday? And that's kind of a recall situation. They also can do it in a self-referential kind of a experiencing mode. They can trigger throughout the day through your phone or through some other mean, a diary perhaps. How do you feel right now? And curiously, there are different results from those different methodologies. Mm-hmm. But they're very correlated, but there are some slight differences there. And so it is kind of a how satisfied, how do you feel? It is an emotion question from the beginning, and it's a positive emotion question. So in that sense, it is very similar to happiness. Mm-hmm. But I think the word satisfied captures it better.
Okay. I mean, would the term content fit in there?
Mm-hmm. Yep, content's one of the words that shows up in some of their surveys.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, let's get in a little bit more detail and talk in some more specifics on the five subcategories. Why don't you tackle one at a time? What's the first one that comes to mind, and explain that a little bit more?
Well, if you get the book Well-Being put out by the Gallup researchers, and there's an entire book on this, they'll tell you that their research suggests the number one is career, at least for working adults, that having a career that you enjoy, that you like going to work each day, that you feel has a meaning behind it, has a purpose, you enjoy your coworkers at work, for example, that correlates more highly with overall well-being than any of the other four.
You know, so there's articles I've written, and there's so many jobs that aren't, they're rote, they need to be done, but it's hard to see how career satisfaction could be from being, oh, maybe a garbage collector or ditch digger or something like that.
Yeah, and it's funny you mention those up because we would naturally think that your job title or description would correlate. So if you're digging a ditch versus being a CEO of a company, but I'm not convinced that there's a great correlation there between those job titles and overall happiness with career. What really contributes to feeling good about your job is that you enjoy it. It plays upon your strengths. You feel like you're doing something meaningful. And I don't know that CEOs feel that way every day. And I don't know that ditch diggers don't feel that way every day.
And maybe it's something like a job well done. You feel like you've done your best. And maybe it's more sort of an internal attitude.
Well, and certainly we all have different strengths and weaknesses and different personalities. So I wouldn't want personally to sit as an accountant all day long. I know that would drive me crazy. But I know people are very happy accountants. So, So that's part of what I wrote in the article was helping your child figure out where their strengths and weaknesses are, maybe allowing them or encouraging them to explore some professions in their areas of strength and just keep telling them, look, this is up to you. You got to enjoy doing this. So don't pick something just for the money. That's another part of what I wrote in there is it's not always the case that the level of pay you get correlates with your well-being. A lot of these other factors are important, but you have a very happy career being a postman, which is what my grandfather did and delivered mail his entire life. I never met a happier, more satisfied man. So keep all that in mind, I guess.
Okay. Okay, what's the second one? The second most important or the second one you want to talk about, subcategory?
Well, they say then that if they did the research, it ends up being social well-being. So when you reflect back on what's going on with you in the last few days or even at the moment, and you're either happy or unhappy with your social life, your relationships with people in your life, that strongly influences your overall satisfaction and well-being. So if we're around people, for example, that are happy, we report more happy. If we're around people who are angry and sad, we report that we're angry and sad. And fortunately,
I would imagine part of that would be having a lot of friends and good friends, a good social circle of friends.
Right.
And if you didn't have that... You know, if you're sort of a loner or didn't have many people you could call friends, then that would be a lower on the social well-being?
Very much so, yeah. You really nailed that one. And you have to understand also that you can't just have one friend who can play all the roles that you need in your friendships. You need different people to be different kinds of friends to you. And that kind of fills up all the different categories. I was in a conversation with one of my daughter's friends. She said that her friend went to a really prestigious school, worked really hard, but didn't feel like she had any friends after the end of the first year. And she was not satisfied with her college experience. She wasn't happy about it. She was thinking of transferring. So when we send our kids off to college or we send them off to work, we have to encourage them to continue to develop social relationships. And that's where the career thing is problematic, I believe. People put too much emphasis on attaining career goals and not enough emphasis on the other four categories. And we have to be careful about that.
Oh, yeah. That reminds me of the old saying, all work and no play makes Jack a dull boy.
Yes. And that's what the research suggests. Exactly. Mm-hmm. So CEOs may not be very happy after all.
Yeah, they tell me it's lonely up at the spot. I haven't been a CEO, but they tell me it's sometimes very lonely there and all these responsibilities. What I've gathered from what you're talking about is social well-being. You've got to feel that you have some friends, some good friends, can play. I presume that's a part of that. And that's part of it. Okay, what's number three?
Well, financial well-being. We do want to help our kids obtain financial security, financial independence. I think all of us as parents want that. When I looked into the research further, I discovered that it wasn't necessarily about your income level. It had a lot more to do with the feeling of financial security that some people attain because they manage their money well and they build assets or wealth over time. So you can make a lot of money, but if you spend a lot of money, you can go into debt. And that burden of debt and that feeling of I'm not ahead and I'm not getting ahead and can really impact your overall well-being. But if you do it the reverse, if you manage to live below your means and you slowly accumulate some wealth, no matter how much that is, if it feels good to you, you can feel good about your financial well-being. There's a similar concept. Go ahead.
Yeah, in my case, let me sort of example. There was times when I've had various jobs at various times and career changes and stuff like that, and on the transition had four small kids, and it was a struggle financially. I didn't feel very good on that because you know going out taking the kids out to McDonald's for a hamburger was a sort of a big deal, and more recently I'm not making all that much money, but we've got most of the debts paid off. We're comfortable. We can do what we really want, and so I'm feeling a lot better financially, but I can definitely remember the times when that was very poor on the well-being scale.
It's very true, and I think that's a good thing that we just need to recognize. We need to get to where we feel financially comfortable. We feel like we have financial security, and that doesn't have to be the same dollar amount for everybody. And if we keep in mind that we want to do that in the context of having good social relationships and a career that we like going to every day, well, then we got three out of the five. We're doing very, very well. Very few people say all three of those are going well for them. It reminds me of a related point. Go ahead.
Hopefully, over time, that's where you can get at. And that's sort of, I guess, the what we call the golden years or retirement. And you're good at all these things, and financially, you can live a good life without having to work 8-10 hours a day.
Yeah, but I think you could feel that way at age 30 or even 20 if you had the proper context.
Sure.
If you're 20 doing a job and you feel like relative to 20-year-olds, I'm doing okay financially, then you'll score well in well-being. You don't compare yourself as a 20-year-old to a 70-year-old and say, well, I don't have the big house and the paid-off car and the retirement home. So there's this thing called relative deprivation in the psychological literature. It's a big deal by economists. One of the studies is, you know, would you accept a job of $50,000 if in your neighborhood everybody made $25,000 versus would you accept a job for $100,000 but everybody in your neighborhood makes $200,000? And kind of surprisingly, many, many people, as many as half, prefer to make $50,000 because they'll be a big fish in a little pond, I guess. They'll feel well financially, even though they're making half the money they would have made in the other scenario. So we have to be careful who we compare ourselves to.
Oh, that's true. But it's also, you know, peers is very important, and the social well-being. I think that my thought was that these two intersect. If you're around people with your peers, then it's not a problem. But if you're the low person in the totem pole, even if you're earning a lot of money, but everybody else around you is more, if those are the people you're dealing with, then you're not going to feel have that sense of social well-being, nor financial.
Sounds
like they go together. I haven't had time to think it through, but yeah, that makes sense. Okay, what's the fourth one?
Physical well-being. People in the Gallup poll who score well there generally will increase their overall well-being score. How do you feel about your health and your wellness in that regard? And I think we're all obviously concerned about that with our children. We want them to grow up to be happy and healthy. But the question becomes, how do we guide them in that direction? And that's a problem. And that's something that I've struggled with as a parent. I think many of us do. We have sugary foods, fatty foods. We have Game Boys to keep them from playing and being physical. We have access to drugs and alcohol more than maybe before. I mean, it's complicated. I don't have a magic bullet for that.
And it's getting more complicated
job we do that, I think.
Electronics.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's getting more complicated with all the electronic gadgets, like you mentioned.
Certainly is. I mean, that impacts the social realm, but also impacts the physical well-being. You know, and schools are cutting back on gym and all that kind of stuff. But go ahead.
Yeah, I imagine the feeling disease or aches and pains could really cut you down. Part of it would be exercise, of course. But some people might have something, a chronic cold or something like that, and that would make you. I've been feeling sick a few times every now and then, and I start feeling a little bit crappy. So that's part of it. The physical health part of it, I would think, would be an important part of that. That suggests that if teenagers are very sedentary and don't get physical exercise, then they're going to, whether they admit it or not, they're going to be pretty low on the well-being scale in that criteria, probably all of them.
Make sense? I think it's mixed a little bit, because another phenomena is that many of them will be in sports, and then the day they stop being in sports, they can't take over that amount of physical activity that was regimented for them for years and years. So I've known a lot of athletes who then go to college and don't play a sport there, and they suddenly gain a lot of weight, get very soft. They don't have the training, the self-discipline to go work out the way they used to, but they haven't compensated in their diet. They haven't found other ways. So there's a lot of reasons that some of us lose our healthiness, and there's no magic bullet about that. It's just telling your kids over and over, like, you're in charge of your body. You're gonna need that for another 80 years. Start taking care of it.
Okay, so self-discipline is an important element, particularly in the physical. Oh, it's all of these. But particularly in physical, that self-discipline, if you don't build your own structure, you rely upon somebody else, and then when you lose that externally imposed, then it falls apart.
Right. And even diet. You know, when I stop making food for my kids and they go off and work or go to college, are they eating right? They were when they lived in my house, but how do I know they're eating right now? So that's another complication.
Yeah, well, you do what you can and cross your fingers, has been my experience.
Yep. I can't argue that.
Okay, number five.
Well, that's called community. So when the Gallup researchers really broke down what contributed to well-being, they discovered that feeling like you're part of the community, that in most cases you volunteer, you connect with it, you attend events, you're not alone in a sense, and you're not an outsider to that community, was a big contributor to overall well-being. And you know, certainly with our kids, we're trying to give them the message that you're expected to go out and do things like volunteer, whatever area you like. We're not going to tell you what, but it's not just about you. It's about everybody around you, and you got to give back through church, through, you know, in an article I mentioned Habitat for Humanity, whatever it might be. It's part of what should be your life from here on out.
You know, a lot of the schools that I work with, that's almost a requirement. These are private parent choice schools for kids with behavioral attitude problems. But an integral part of just about every one of them is community service. And I think it's hitting exactly what you're talking about. And I'm thinking of several adults I know. Some have moved around, and they hit a new town and they find a church community, or they join a political party. That's their sense of community, or they do any number of things, but they're aware that they need that. It's when somebody doesn't seek out community that they start falling apart together.
Yeah. Well, they'll start to move lower on that well-being scale is what the research suggests. So,
go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, so we look at each of these five categories of well-being. You know, what can we do to first, you know, maybe role model and also encourage these behaviors, these considerations, these goals in our children? And that's where the rubber hits the road. And that's why I wrote the article of two parents. You know, ask yourself, are you doing things that encourages each of these five things? Are you just doing one? Are you just doing two? And are you role modeling and making these things habits Or you just doing it, you know, every once in a while, like once a year?
Okay, well, that sort of turns into turning into the next question, because as we went through them, I was thinking in terms of myself in order to better understand it. But how can a parent best use this perspective and turn it around to where they're looking at it? Well, it's probably good to look at it for themselves too, but look at it for their kids. So could you talk about some of these and what they can do, maybe some specifics or some examples of what you've done or what you've seen done in order to help kids get on the right track for this well-being?
Well, I think it's very situational specific, unfortunately, and I'll try to share a few things, but I definitely think it's responding to the child in front of you. So I know that we've not done the same thing for all three of our children in every circumstance. We've tried to adapt to what is this kid like? What is this kid going through right now? Where can we get our kid to a better place? So keep that in mind as I answer these. But some of the things I think that you do as a parent is if you have the goal in mind, you can at least respond to the specifics knowing where you want to get to. And I definitely think you have to balance these off of each other sometimes. Unfortunately, for example, it's not about being smart. None of these say that, well, to be well, have high well-being, you got to have a high IQ. So if I'm struggling with getting my kid to get higher grades or not studying enough, I can step back and say, okay, but how are we doing in the other categories? Oh, can we balance one off of another for a while? And try to build that up in a more gradual fashion. I don't have to make my kid, for example, have stupendous career well-being, but at the sacrifice of the other four.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. So that's important.
So that's where I think the rubber hits the road a little bit, as you say, as a parent, like, I got to balance these things off of each other, and I got to respond specifically to this kid in front of me. But then when you break down each category, I'm sure each parent has really good ideas. For example, the financial well-being. And ultimately, my kid needs to learn how to live below their means. So can I look at what they're doing and say, yeah, this kid knows how to save, knows how to struggle for a while towards a goal that they think is worth it, or is it not the case? And if not, then what can I do to encourage that attitude, that behavior?
My first thought on that is that you're sort of a salmon going against the going upstream against the current, because there's a lot of criticisms that the younger generation are narcissistic. There's me first and that kind of thing, and money is important, and so there's a lot of things that parents have to do that are against the grain of what our society seems to be doing. Have you seen that? Did you agree?
Yeah, I think that's probably always the case. I think that, the younger generation is always trying to create and more susceptible to change, and the older generation is in control and wants things to go along the way they're most comfortable with.
Uh-huh.
So there's always that bit of tension between the child pulling away from the authority and the parents, particularly in the teenage years. And I think that's a natural part of the process. I know each of my kids have gone through a period where they specifically don't want to listen to us. And I think that's natural.
Oh, boy.
I never panic about it. I just go, yeah.
Well, I remember when I was a kid, I was sort of that way. I worked out with my parents. I'll listen to your advice, but then I'll decide whether to accept it or not. And did some of that pulling away. I wanted independence. I was in a hurry to grow up and have all these things on that. Okay, well, let's talk a little bit more. How can parents best use this perspective? So we've talked about some principles here, but more examples. If you can think of some more examples, or maybe in your practice you've come up with people who've talked to you about some of the things that they've said. What have been some solutions? Let's some examples, because I think some people learn best by specific examples of how parents have approached this with their kid.
Well, you can just pick a category. You want to pick one, or should I pick one?
Well, let's start with the career.
Okay. So it can be one of the career issues that children face is they're not really exposed to a lot of careers. I've talked with career counselors in high schools, and there's a strong tendency for children to most naturally try to pick the career that their parent has had. They get a lot of exposure to it. They know a lot about it. It feels very comfortable to them, and maybe they even get encouraged by their parent to do so. But, you know, a child is always a mixing of two sets of genes, and who knows what kind of third variables come out of that. So it may not be the case that the kid is best adapted to that career. So I think we need to really encourage exploration of careers amongst our kids. They may be much better off in something that's not related to what we did when we were, what we do as in our careers, their parents.
Okay. Now, I forgot to mention earlier on those that are listening live on the website, there's a chat function down at the bottom, and you could ask questions of Eric on that. But one of the questions here that one of our guests put in is it ever too late to change, or how long does it take to change behavior? So do you want to respond to that?
Well, it's never too late to change. I strongly believe in that, and there's all kind of evidence that no matter what kind of behaviors you're engaged in, even drug addicts can fully recover. I mean, there are people in terrible situations that find a way through that, and a religious conversion is sometimes probably the strongest evidence for that, when you see that happen sometimes. But barring that kind of radical makeover of a person, it's difficult for people who've gotten habits and behavioral patterns to change, because many times they're being rewarded by that behavior, rewarded in a way that isn't obvious to others, and therefore they're not really addressing what the behavior needs to change about the behavior. For example, I know a person who drinks a lot, but they're very smart and they're very successful, and they struggled with it. We had some conversations about it, and what we discovered was he drank because it was a way to turn off this part of his brain that always wanted to be productive, constantly working. He was a workaholic, and by drinking, he gave himself permission not to work. So it was a way to relax in a weird kind of way. And until we face that, and that's what we need to address, we had to then just find other ways for him to relax that didn't involve alcohol. So everything is unique and specific to the person, because we're pretty complex. But that might show you how it's a very, very hard answer, how to change people's behavior.
Well, yeah, it is hard but necessary, and I work in an area where a lot of the parents I work with, they have teenagers. The teenagers are getting into trouble with lots of problems, and oftentimes it comes back to the parents weren't a team, or they're divorced, or they were too permissive, and they've gotten to a situation to where they have to change if they're going to give the kid a chance, and it can be done with determination. But it just it's hard to do, and the important thing is just to recognize this ain't working the way they're parenting.
Yes. Well, I support everything you just said. Yep, exactly.
Okay. Well, another question that is on the chat function is with the cost of insurance, how to prepare kids for all the things that are to come? And then they're thinking in the financial, you know, cost of insurance, cost of a variety of things. And so that sort of fits in the financial, and I guess career, well, all of them, but then those do. So how do you prepare the kids for what to come without scaring the crap out of them?
Well, I mean, I think what's implied there is the fear that things are going to get so expensive that my kids or kids in general won't be able to keep up, that they're going to fall behind inevitably. Mm-hmm. And that almost implies kind of a futuristic / political question. I don't know what the future of America is going to look like. I don't know if insurance is going to be the biggest issue, or if it might be something different. And I've had lots of conversation with parents that are more worried about drugs than they are about the cost of insurance, or more worried about other health issues that they're afraid of, poisons in the water, toxins, cancer. There's a lot of things to be afraid of, I'll be quite honest.
It's always been that way. I remember my parents were despairing of my generation. Well, somehow we managed to muddle through.
Yeah.
So and this generation will muddle through too somehow.
That's what I was going to get around to saying is, you know, the last part of my article says one of the most important things separate from these five is hope and optimism. If you want your child eventually to feel good about themselves and about their life, you have to encourage hope inside of them, hope and optimism. And if you're not role modeling that, if all they ever see are behaviors which are despairing and complaining, et cetera, what do we expect them to feel and how do we expect them to act when they get our age? Probably the same way. And that's, again, this is that self-reflective.
That's good insight because the hope, you know, hope and optimism is important. Easier said than done, but I like what you said earlier about role modeling. The parents have to role model in these areas, and that's probably the best way to teach a good, healthy sense of well-being. We'll have another question along this line of how subjective are the understandings? These understandings, as you could say, well, that's just subjective. Who knows where, you know, preparing for a career or if they're doing right physically or in these various areas. So how objective can, there's a subjective criteria you can do, or is it just really subjective? You know, evaluating your kids.
It basically the well-being is a subjective measure. So it's asking you, how do you feel about you? And in that regard, all of these are subjective. So how do I feel at age 30 about my career well-being, about my financial well-being, about my physical well-being, et cetera? Without a doubt, they're subjective. Can we as parents evaluate how well our kids are doing each of those categories outside of asking the kid? I think we probably can do some of that. So I can look at my kid and look at his bank account and say, he doesn't seem to have any financial discipline. That concerns me. I'm going to have to start encouraging, teaching my child to have some self-discipline in his finances. So I think I can do that in each of the five areas to some degree. But ultimately, the well-being is a subjective measure.
Would it help to bring in somebody else, get the attitude of a neighbor or a friend or a relative or grandparents or pastor or something like that? Wouldn't that help to see if they see the same thing you see?
Yes. Yeah, I think that's a good idea. And co-parenting, you mentioned team. You talked earlier about parenting. It reminded me when I was thinking about this phone call we're going to have today. I mean, I've only seen two parents intimately in my life. Those are my two parents. But when I became a co-parent with my wife, who had a different set of parents, I learned so much about other ways of parenting.
And I bet she learned the same.
Yeah, she did too, I'm sure. But then again, that's only four that we've ever known intimately. And there's, 7 billion people on the planet? So there are lots of other ways to parent that I've never been exposed to, that we never, at least intimately, never got exposed to, never got to see in a day-to-day basis. And I think we as parents have to open ourselves up to other ways of parenting. And that's where roles people like you who can consult, who can come in and show other ways of parenting are very, very valuable to today's parents.
Well, I know as an educational consultant, that's part of what I do is a reflection. And I try to talk sensitively but straight with the parents if I see that there's a problem, you know, if they're too permissive. And the kids are getting away with things and getting the wrong attitude, or if they're too harsh. But I have seen more problem with permissive than too harsh, it seems like, on that. And I could also see it's interacting, because I would be willing to bet, and I'm sure in most of the cases or situations you've ran into, the parents, while they're trying to teach their kids these well-being and guide them in the right directions, they're having to work on their own issues.
Right.
And so definitely, that gets to be a complicated thing. Maybe the parents can learn something from the kids, especially their kids that are growing up fine.
Well, and I'm a big proponent of lifelong learning. I know I continue to evolve as a parent, as a learner, as a person who's interested in being better. And I encourage that on everyone listening, that open that up to yourself. And whatever you're doing as a parent, you could probably do something slightly different and do it better. Just be aware of that and look for those opportunities.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, we have about 10 minutes left, and I would like you to talk a little bit about your practice, how you're using these concepts. Like you said, you wrote an article, and you're referring to an article that you've written with this title, How Do You Know When You're Done Parroting? So how do you use this? You've written, I think you've said you've given lectures and things. How do you use these concepts?
Well, that I really appreciate the question, and then I apologize for not getting to you ahead of time. I don't really do any kind of consulting on parenting. This was an anomaly, this particular article for me. I work in the area of self-management and leadership, and this article was simply prompted by some conversations with some friends. I took a stab at it, and I've been really blessed with the response to it and the conversations I've had about it, but I don't do anything like you do. I don't do educational consulting. I don't do anything with parenting groups, at least not at the moment. And so I don't have any practice that I can refer to other than, you know, I think my kids are doing okay, but that's probably due to my wife, not as much to me.
Well, that's a wise husband when he gives most credit to the wife.
Yes, exactly. And but we like to joke that they didn't have any chance to be normal because she's a psychologist as well. So between the two of us, we knew we were going to screw them up from the beginning.
You know, there's one thing, and let's talk about this and your observations. I would appreciate your observations. But one thing that I've noticed, that, and I've heard several comments over the last 20 or 30 years, that the parents are the expert on their children. And if they listen to their instincts, they do a lot better than listening to the advice in books and how-to and of experts. What do you think of that?
Oh, I would strongly disagree with that. Mm-hmm. And I can think of multiple reasons why. I mean, first of all, something I already mentioned, the only person I've ever seen parent is my parent, or parents plural. That's a very small sample size. And second, I think that there's a defense mechanism at work there. You know, if my parents did okay and it worked for me, therefore whatever they did will work for my child because I turned out just fine. I'm a little nervous about people with that reaction. I don't feel like I turned out just fine. I feel like I'm a work continually in progress. And I've spent a lot of time in the social sciences. I have a PhD from the University of Michigan and was a faculty at the University of Georgia in psychology for years. I still learned a ton about things that I could have been, that I could improve in. And I got exposed to the greats in the field. If you've never studied the masters, so to speak, in philosophy, social science, psychology, sociology, there's a lot you don't know that other really smart people have discovered. And I fear that kind of approach that, well, it worked for me, it'll work for my kids.
Well,
it's like saying, well, we rode a horse.
There's a lot of people like that, and that just doesn't make sense because the world's constantly changing. But it's talking about the instinct. I think it's talking more about the instinct that parents have. They see the kid in front of them, they see what the kid needs, and then they check a book. Well, what did Dr. Spock say about it? Or what did so-and-so say about it? When oftentimes with the parent, you just know what they need to do. Now, the weakness is it's based, of course, as you point out, is based upon your experience, and if you're just duplicating what your parents did, that's going to be pretty weak. But I think that's what they're talking about. Look at the child in front of you. You know your child better than any expert.
Okay. Well, let me take that to a different tangent then, because what I hear you saying now is does the parent need to respond to that specific kid in that specific situation? And I wholeheartedly believe in that. If that's what you meant by instinct, like there are great abstract theories and principles, but right this second, there's a kid in front of me saying this and doing this, and I need to do what I think is right in response to that. Yeah, it's all very situation specific. The principles are there to guide us, but at the moment of decision, yeah, you're going to have to go with all the information you have, and a lot of that is coming from the kid and you and the context, and the principles are just one thing to consider.
And you can be informed by the principle based upon what people that have studied it and their research, right?
Yes, and I think the variable, I think what where I'm working my mind around to is the concept of change. If what you're doing is working and it's based on instinct, go for it. Nobody wants to have any argument with you about that. I guess the question is, if it doesn't work and you're searching for change, is that change going to come from your instinct? Most likely not. What you're getting from your rapid thought processes, which we call instinct, are probably the same answers they gave you before. You need to change. This is where you might want to access experts who've got alternative points of view.
Right. You're talking about old tapes that you learned from your parents, and that's not necessarily going to be the best way.
Right.
Okay.
It works.
Yeah.
Great.
Well, well, you got to have that sensitivity. I presume in this whole thing of raising parents and guiding them in this area, a sense of humor is very important.
Oh, I believe so. Yeah. I'm a big fan of that. We have a lot of funny posters hanging around our house all the time. We rotate them constantly.
Yeah, I know of my kids, at one point, and one of my daughters, I put a sign up outside her door, "Bless this mess." It was so horrible, you'd break something if you walked on the floor. And she turned out to be a good housewife, a good professional, and a clean house, and the whole thing. But as a teenager, I despaired. And I think that's often what happens to parents. You despair of your teenagers, and then miracle upon miracle, they turned out all right. Most of the time.
Right. Yeah, most of the time. And I think that's where the help and optimism needs to be held up as a goal, something we need to role model inside ourselves. Mm-hmm. It'll all hopefully be all right. Let's keep the hope.
You know, you're talking, I want to give you a few minutes before we finish up. We've got about, three, 4 minutes left. But you're talking about Leadership Academy, leadership training, and things like that. And I think there's an overlap. That's in a professional and adult, but I think there's an overlap with parenting because it's dealing with human nature. So could you explain a little bit what you do? If somebody had any questions, wanted to follow up, how to get a hold of you. But I guess it's the few minutes I always give for a bit of a commercial break. So go to it. The next 2 or 3 minutes are yours.
Well, I appreciate that. Most of the folks that I work with, it's in a coaching relationship. There's someone that wants to work on some change in their life. Occasionally, it's a personal issue. A couple of people I've talked with have had divorces they've struggled through. But I'm more of a positive psychologist. So instead of helping people with dysfunction, I'm more of the type to help person who's doing okay and really wants to push themselves to another level. So you'll end up doing more leadership kind of coaching, executive coaching, they call it, where someone sees they might have a blind spot or they have something that's difficult and they can't seem to overcome it. Then the coach in a situation applies in those contexts. And I'm a role model for that. I've gone through several career changes myself. I'm the type who pushes myself pretty hard. In fact, I'm doing a triathlon this Saturday, and that's what I like to do is practice self-discipline and self-management and then teach that to others. I guess that's it in a nutshell.
Okay, well, that sure translates down to the teens and kids.
Yeah, I hope it does. I'll let you know in 20 years how my kids turn out.
Well, sounds like they're doing fine, and it's probably the die is cast, and they're probably going to do okay. If they're doing okay now at this age, then if you have any serious problems, they probably got their head screwed on more or less. Properly.
Well, again, I give my wife all the credit for that.
In your background, you've done a lot of articles, and published over 60 columns in national magazines. Is that 60 different series, or if it's that's the total entries in the columns you've written?
No, those are just one-offs. I just started writing about a year and a half ago for national magazines, and so I've accumulated those bylines. Before that, I published in peer-reviewed journals. Peer-reviewed psychology journals. That's a much smaller set, but that's a lot of research went into those. And then I made a lot of educational television. As a psychologist, I got into hosting TV shows and loved it so much, I switched careers into the television production and hosting and script writing. I did that for several years.
Are you still doing that, or?
No, not currently. No, I'm writing more often than I'm doing anything with video. And as I said, doing leadership coaching and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, we have about 1 minute left. Do you have anything more to add before I close us out?
Well, you know, I would just encourage folks to continue to listen to your program and to continue to seek out expertise in any area that they feel less than 100% competent. And that's that lifelong learning. You as a parent, embrace that. You can be a lifelong learner as a parent. Do it in other areas of your life, but certainly do it in parenting. Because if there's any job that changes continuously, I think it's parenting.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Eric. This is Lon Woodbury with the Woodbury Report. And we've been talking about how do you know when you're done parenting? And I guess the answer is when they have their act together on these five areas of wellness that he talked about. Well, this is Lon Woodbury in North Idaho with the Woodbury Report. Thank you very much for joining us. And join us again next week, noon on Tuesdays on K4HD.